Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Toral Kornfeldt, which is the Texan way of saying her name. I did my best that I could with that, and we're going to let her say her name for all the Scandinavian audiences out there because, hey, I did the best I could, Toral.
Actually, I'm quite impressed. So if I would say it myself, I would say Toral Kornfeldt. But, you know, close enough.
Well, I was actually quite impressed that the Shepherd knew that Sweden was in Scandinavia, so we're already a little bit further ahead of the curve than we expected at this point in the
episode. That is the public education system in the United States. I was able to put two and two together there.
Our experience in the United States of Sweden has been the chef on the Muppet Show,
pretty much. And the bikini team.
Yeah, and that.
That's pretty much it. That's literally what I know about Sweden. Oh, and Swedish fish. The candy that comes out around Halloween.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what I know about Sweden. So
I was about to say that's what most people in Sweden know about Sweden as well, but that's not quite true. We also have IKEA.
Oh, yeah. We forgot about IKEA.
That's because we don't furniture shop. No.
Yeah.
That's right. So before we start, we know with the topic of this podcast, it's going to get flagged pretty quickly on YouTube by a bunch of conspiracy theorists who will listen to what you say and decide that the world is going to head towards some type of dystopia. Now, I'm hoping, and the Shepherd is hoping, that you're about to present to us a utopian world involving genetics. Can you tell us about your book? And especially about the title. I love the title of your book.
Yeah, so my book is called The Unnatural Selection of Our Species. And it is a book about all of the things that genetic editing and the new genetic technologies can do to ourselves, to our bodies, to our society, to future generations. And I try to hit a note in the book of somewhere between utopia and dystopia. I think this is an extremely powerful tool that will help the lives of a lot of people. But as with any, you know, as with any powerful tool, there are potential misuses. But I have to say I'm mainly optimistic about the future and how we can use this technology to make our bodies healthier and better and cure diseases.
Yeah, I think the difference between utopia and dystopia is sometimes in the eye of the beholder, the objectivity involved, because certainly what we've already achieved and we can replicate in science involving gene sequencing, messing around with genetics, people see that as playing God. And that even if we have the ability to eradicate genetic-based diseases or ailments, that we shouldn't do it, that we should let this natural selection and nature's lottery play a part. So, I mean, you're always going to come up against opposition. And have you had much of that opposition from various groups, either concerned about where it's heading or just blanket out against it based upon religious principles?
I think the argument about playing God is, I find it really interesting because we're not against houses. I mean, we don't look at, you know, a building and go, that is playing God. We shouldn't live inside buildings. We should live out in the fields as God intended or as nature intended or whatever, as is our natural state. And, you know, people don't look at airplanes and go, that is against nature. This is, you know, a blasphemy. It's these very specific things where this argument comes up, and usually it's connected to our bodies, and usually it's connected to areas of self-governing and self-control of our bodies and who should control them. And I think we are, when it comes to curing diseases, the idea of not playing God is, I mean, if that's what you want to do, then that train has left the station a very long time ago. several hundred years ago. And, you know, we've used antibiotics for almost a century now, and about a century since they were discovered, and so on. With that said, I mean, I think some of the concerns are valid. I think there are reasonable concerns about how we use this technology. And as technologies grow more powerful, you also end up in a situation where the consequences of using them can have larger effects. I haven't had much pushback from a religious perspective, but I also think that's a result of Sweden being not a very religious country in most aspect, in the sense that religion doesn't really play a large part in political discussions. People have faith and you know, go to church, but religion doesn't really play a part in politics.
Gotcha. No, that makes total sense. And what you're basically describing kind of reminds me a little bit about Spider-Man, the whole "with great power comes great responsibility" kind of quote that's always thrown out there with something like this, right? That now you're talking about that manipulation that could be used for a nefarious purpose or could be used for a very positive purpose, curing diseases, things like that. And like you say, the boat left the harbor, whatever, a long time ago with the use of antibiotics and things of that nature. But how do you foresee kind of that watch over of that responsibility, the giving this ability to doctors or scientists or whatever to be able to do this? How can that be given some kind of oversight?
I think we're going to see a lot of interesting discussions about what constitutes a disease. So to start off with, there are two very distinct different types of genetic changes when it comes to our body. So there are the changes that you can do to an adult body. So the things I could possibly do to myself or a doctor could do to me, which would be things like changing specific organs or changing specific cells within my body. If I have, for example, a liver disease, there's some research going on, blood diseases, things that happens in the eye and so on. And those would be in some ways a lot more powerful than traditional medicine, or, you know, the kind of medicine we use today. Traditional medicine has a slightly different meaning, but you know, the regular medicine today. But they would be, the consequences of those treatments would be limited to my body. Now, the other type of genetic engineering or genetic changes that people are talking about doing to humans are involving embryos. So eggs, sperms, or, you know, the first couple of cells. And those might be extremely useful and powerful in treating severe genetic disorders, but the consequences of those are not only that every single cell in the human that results from that embryo will be changed, but also that human's future eggs and sperm will also be changed. So you create a change that will be inherited by that person's children. So you create something that in theory could be, you know, with humanity from then on to the end of history.
Gosh, yeah, a lot to dive in on that. I'm going to take the adult part first. So for those that are only listening, not watching, you wear glasses. So this would be something that you could look at and say, using this kind of technology, not LASIK or something like that, but you could actually use this technology so you no longer have to wear glasses.
Yeah, something like that. We're not quite there yet, but there are a lot of people who have vision deficiencies in different ways that where treatment are looking now. One of the things that are difficult with genetic engineering, if looking at adult humans, is making sure that enough cells are changed, so that you changed as many cells as possible in the body. But I think we're going to see, even with this type of technology, we're going to see a discussion of, you know, what is disease, where is the line towards what is healthy. So right now we think we have a clear idea of, you know, these are the things that are diseases. We're all really happy about using perhaps this kind of technology. Most people are happy about using this kind of technology for things like sickle cell anemia, for example. And then we have the things that are, you know, really common, but, you know, still clearly diseases, cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson, heart diseases, that kind of thing, where most people will still be really happy to use this kind of technology to ease things. And then you start getting into the area of things that are, you know, are these personality traits? Are they diseases? That's one area of, you know, starting to look at cognitive variants, for example. But also, I think we're going to see a shift in, you know, how do we view aging? Is this something that we can, a lot of the research companies that are looking into to curing aging in different ways are looking into genetic editing for that purpose. And then you might end up with a situation where, you know, the 80-year-old man or woman goes to the doctor and says, doctor, I'm really sick. There's clearly something wrong with me. I've only been able to run one marathon this week. And you're going to sort of have a shifting baseline of what is healthy and what isn't. A lot of that's going to be really fantastic and really nice, but you're also going to run into some risks of where are the edges here, and how where do we sort of say that, you know, this isn't a disease anymore, this isn't something we should change, or this isn't something we should treat, or, you know, this sort of personality trait or these kind of ways of looking at the world are not a disease. They are something that is a normal variety that we should celebrate rather than try to streamline. I think that is going to be really difficult and interesting conversation when this technology really starts to be more widely used.
Now, with a lot of diseases which come from genetic mutation, is it possible to completely do something to our DNA to prevent mutation of various parts of it? Because it doesn't matter how perfect we get at, you know, making designer babies, if, you know, the body is still prone to mutation through the DNA or RNA, then we're still going to have these issues that, you know, unless we introduce another thing of, well, if we identify every step of the way in the womb where this baby's at, and oh, we can see now it's going to develop this, you know, do we terminate the pregnancy? That starts getting into a really sticky ground. So for babies coming into the world, is this really going to change anything if those mutations occur? But also, is it possible to stop those mutations occurring in the first place?
I think the different types of diseases that can be treated with this this technology has a lot to do with their effect on the body. So anything that has, there's about 6,000 diseases known, well-documented diseases that are caused by a single mutation. So a single known mutation in a gene ends up with about 6,000 diseases. And for some of them, where there's a clear sort of cause and effect and they have a limited effect on a part of a body. So say sickle cell anemia, it only affects the red blood cells. They are all coming from more or less the same source of stem cells. Then you have a really clear area of the body where you can go in and do some changes. So sickle cell anemia is really, really high on the list of diseases that can be properly treated, even in adults, fairly soon. There are other diseases where the effect of the mutation is a lot more body-wide, and there you're going to have a lot harder time to go in and change enough cells so that you get the proper sort of treatment in the whole body. But I know that there are British scientists right now who are working on doing genetic treatments on babies already in the womb. So you get to that kind of middle ground where you don't do the treatment so early that it will become inherited to the next generation, but hopefully early enough to sort of cover some of the wider body effects in the growing children. But as you say, this also comes with a lot of genetic testing. Those sort of go hand in hand. If you want to treat something, you have to test for it. And if you start testing for it, there's always going to be a discussion of, you know, would it be better to terminate the pregnancy? Would it be better to not have children or to use donated sperms or donated eggs rather than risk having a child with this disease, for example? Or would it be better to make a choice between eggs and use an IVF treatment so that you make sure you don't take eggs or sperm with mutations in them when they are known? And that sort of selection of traits in humans, I think, is also going to be a really tricky conversation to have.
Now, other than having a background in biology, you also started a successful radio show, Tech Safari. With the merging of tech and science now, probably greater than ever, so much that they're almost inseparable, where do you see your future going in this kind of way? More towards the tech side or staying kind of in the strict science discipline?
I really like the edge. I really like hanging out just in the edge of, you know, science, technology and society, because those areas really affect each other so much. You can see, you know, what kind of funding goes into science and is, you know, ruled by society, and then that results in different kind of science, and then that results in what kind of technology gets developed, and you can have this sort of back and forth between these areas, which I think are really interesting. And I now am mainly focusing on different types of future scenarios in different areas. So looking at right now, apart from only looking at genetic technology, which I have focused a lot on and I still focus really a lot on, I'm also focusing on, you know, what will a world look like after climate change. So after the world has stepped up and made sure that we actually stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius, what's the world going to look like after that? How are we going to create a world that deals with that and other sort of issues? So right now I'm focusing a lot on the tech plus science plus society creating a future thing, which I find hard but super interesting.
Yeah, I got to thinking about my father, who grew up, you know, in the 40s, the 1940s, right in the middle of World War II, just as a kid, and then fast forward several years later and is sitting hearing a news report about scientists cloning a sheep. And my dad saying, I never thought this would be possible. This was always science fiction that we were going to be able to clone sheep and do that. And of course, that was years ago, right? And since then, you know, major advancements in cloning. You're talking about the future. And a lot of times when you hear that word future, you think distant future, right? But really and truly, when you're talking future, you're kind of talking right around the corner, right?
Yes. So next, maybe 5-10 years. And I think what's really interesting, you know, harking back to your father, is that so in the 40s, 60s, even 90s, when the first cloned sheep, Dolly, was born, there was a situation where science fiction and the sort of idea of what the future was still quite, you know, ahead of where science was. So you can still get this, that sense of, you know, we're not, you know, it's far away. And now we're at a situation where, you know, there's a lot of wonderful science fiction being written. I really love the genre. But we're at a situation where what people's idea of what the future might look like, a lot of the things has already happened. So, for example, in 2018, the first two genetic children that were edited in a way that means that their changes are going to be inherited by their children, they've already been born. Like, they're soon to be, you know, they're 3 years old now. It's so a lot of the things that we still think of as far away in the future are already happening.
I know he wants to ask a question here, but yep. This is the first I've heard honestly, about these kids from 2018. Can you elaborate a little more on that? Because I could,
yes,
I can definitely see some people wanting to do some research on this. I mean, you definitely almost knocked me out of my chair. Like, I didn't even know this was even happening right now. So
I know, and yeah, it's a really bizarre and strange story. So there was a researcher in China named He Jiankou. And he reached out to couples where one person in the couple had HIV. And it's worth knowing that if you have HIV in China, you cannot get governmental help to have children. So there are techniques to make sure that you can have healthy children, even if one of the parents are an HIV carrier. But that is not available in China for political reasons. So this researcher, he reached out to these couples and he said, I can offer you a genetic change for your children that will probably make them resistant to HIV. So this is a known mutation that seems to protect people from catching HIV. There hasn't been that much studies on it because you don't want to purposefully try to infect people with a deadly disease. But it seems to actually provide quite a lot of protection. So he ended up with a handful of couples, two of which were that actually resulted in pregnancies. And what he did was that in the first, you know, the first embryonic stages where there was just a single cell, he went in and used the genetic editing technology CRISPR and made a change in a specific gene to create a mutation that will give this protection. And the first two twins, who have the, there's not their real name. What's the English word for sort of fake names or
alias?
Aliases.
The aliases are Lulu and Nana. And they were born in October, November 2018. And he presented these results on a conference just a few weeks after. And at the conference, there was a second woman who was still, he told people that there was a second woman who was also pregnant with a changed baby. And it turned out during that conference where he presented his results and an hour-long question and answer session that he did not have permits to do this kind of research. And as soon as he walked off the stage, he was basically grabbed by the Chinese government. He has been in prison since. It took about a year for the Chinese government to release a statement to say that he had been charged and ended up in prison. And the proper scientific documentation of this study hasn't been published yet. The only thing known is what he presented at this conference. And there has been no known information about the children since then. So the Chinese government has put a lid on it since that date.
You know, it's always kind of demeaning, right, when you talk to somebody that speaks multiple languages because they can use that excuse. Like, what is the English word for this?
Right.
Yeah. When you and I sit here and we can't think of the word, we can't say, so what is the Swedish word for this? You know, because that isn't going to work because we don't speak Swedish. Yeah. But so super jealous of you about that one. I mean, I always wanted to be able to use that excuse. So what is the English word for this? Like, well, why wouldn't you know? You don't know any other languages.
Well, I think
it's a bit of a cop out because it's alias in Swedish as well.
I think we're gonna have to
see. You didn't have to let us know that, though. We would have never known. It's not like we're gonna look up what the Swedish word for that is.
Yeah, I think if we get in contact with our Chinese spy over there, huge anus, he can keep us up to date with what's going on. But it does kind of lead to this situation where even if we put a ceiling on the research in the Western world and say that morally we're not going to go past a certain point, we know in places like China, they're going to go past that certain point. And so if we stick to rules and abide by them, we're going to have a somewhat natural evolution, whereas China is going to produce, you know, later on down the line, people who are a very artificial evolution. What would that mean to have, you know, one half of the world which is genetically, you know, designed, and another half of the world which is still somewhat sticking to the old,
more, you know, traditional,
yeah, traditional way? Yeah,
I think we're gonna, yeah, I think it's gonna be interesting. And I think this is not, you're not only gonna see a geographical spread here, because when this became known, of course there was a large outcry between or among scientists who were against this, but there's also been a few voices of people who want to keep doing this kind of studies, especially a very vocal Russian scientist who is looking for couples to do similar studies with. But what also became known was that this researcher He Yangku was looking for and had obtained some funding to set up a clinic, I think in Thailand, for what he called elite customers who wanted to buy this kind of treatment. And we're already seeing that reproduction tourism is a huge industry, and people who have the means travel to wherever they can to do the kind of treatments that aren't allowed in whatever country they're from originally, and sometimes also because it's cheaper. I know a lot of people in the US go for IVF treatments abroad because of the cost of your healthcare system. And so you're going to have a situation where you have differences between countries in regulations. So you're going to have some differences in what kind of treatments and healthcare that are being offered in different areas. But you're also going to have a situation where people who have money and resources are going to be able to get treatments for themselves and especially for future babies wherever they want and wherever, you know, that they would be legal. So you're going to have a division geographically, but also a really strong sort of class division of how people use those resources.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And to be honest with you, if you wouldn't have described it that way, reproductive tourism sounds really fun.
Yeah,
I mean, that sounds like something that you would see an ad on certain websites say, yeah, hey, are you interested in reproductive tourism? Come to this all-inclusive resort and, you know, kind of like a hedonistic, like,
thought that's how we ended up with a lot of anchor babies in the United States, reproductive tourism.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of all part of certain ones of those wars and everything. But yeah, unfortunately, like you say, because we have these different healthcare systems all across the world, and you have socialized or nationalized healthcare in some countries, and then, you know, you have the American model and all that good stuff. And let's be honest, we could go hours on the American model of healthcare, and we don't want to go down that road. But
it looks very strange from the outside, I have to say.
It looks strange from the inside.
I remember when I was in Australia, I had been in Papua New Guinea, which is just north of Australia, and I contracted malaria while I was there, and I got the medicine and everything, but I was still sick, and I was in Australia waiting to, you know, hop a plane to come back over to the States, and I got so sick that there was a phone number in the hotel that we were staying at in Australia about, you know, here's a doctor's office you can go to. So we call the doctor's office, you know, we go into the doctor and he sees me and he's like, okay, you know, yeah, you know, you have malaria. The medicine you're taking is what you need to be taking. I'm going to give you this additional medicine. It's going to kind of help you with all of the side effects, basically, of the medication. Because when you get malaria, the side effects of the medication are almost worse than the disease. So we finish off. And by the way, I'm 18 at the time. I'm with my father. And so we're done, and as typical Americans, we walk out, and my dad's got his credit card in his hand, and he's like, so who do I pay for this? And they said, pay for what? And we said, well, we came to see the doctor. There's got to be some kind of charge. And they looked at us funny, like, no, this is free. It's part of the government. And we're like, yeah, but we're not citizens, so we got to owe something. And like, no, you don't owe anything. And we scratched our heads driving on the wrong side of the road back to the hotel trying to figure out, you know, how that even works. So kind of that huge long explanation there going to kind of my next point, my next question. Do you see this getting picked up more in those countries that already have that government funded medical program, so it's easy to implement, versus the reproductive tourism of a profit healthcare system?
That is a really interesting question. I think it's going to develop really differently looking at how this technology develops. So I was, during the research for my book, I was visiting China and I was in a cancer clinic where they try to use genetic editing to cure cancer, which is also one of the sort of early adaptions that's probably going to have huge effect. And what became clear there was that it was not, you know, a silver bullet. It wasn't 100% effective for everyone, but it actually cured and helped some patients that were sort of out of hope when it came to all of other options. So it was quite optimistic anyway. But what became clear was that it was always time consuming and expensive, because what you do is that you take out the patient's own blood and you do genetic engineering to a subset of cells in the blood. You grow those up in a lab and then you inject them back in to the patient. And then those modified immuno cells hopefully find and attack the cancer in a way they weren't able to before. And that the fact that there is that kind of time consuming personalized process means that it will never be cheap. So the actual gene editing, doing the CRISPR, you know, the small CRISPR part of it, that's going to be cheap. That's already cheap. You know, you can order a CRISPR set and do this at home. But the process of individualizing and just spending time on this means it's not going to be cheap. And that means that countries like Sweden, for example, that have a state-funded healthcare are going to have more problems implementing this broadly, because there's going to be a huge societal cost, where a country like the US, this might become like a premium option that you can pay for. So it might end up being available to more people in the US because you can pay for it, whereas the Swedish government perhaps might deem that it's too expensive.
Yeah, now, I have to get this question out of the way. You might have noticed in the background, and for the benefit of our listeners, that we have some Star Wars stuff. Yep. Are you a Star Wars fan at all?
You know what? I just started watching. Like, I watched the original series a few years ago.
Okay.
And it was quirky and adorable. And now I've just started to watch the, you know, the one with Picard and... And you know, I love
No, that's Star Trek.
You're talking about Star Trek.
Star Wars, sorry. Yeah, rookie mistake. I thought you meant Star Trek because that's more technology heavy. Actually, I'm not really a Star Wars fan. Probably could tell by my answer.
Anyway, I had a Star Wars related question.
Yeah.
So this ought to go over ahead. Really
yeah.
well.
Yeah. Especially to like not a natural first language as well. In one of the earlier movies of the prequels... the prequel trilogy, they develop a clone army from one base human. Is that actually possible to replicate, you know, pretty much genetically the same physiological, you know, traits continuously enough so that you could actually literally produce a clone army as such? Or would there still be so much variance that some people would be good at something and probably not be suited to fighting in an army at all? Would it be possible to do that?
Yes. So we haven't been able to clone humans yet. I mean, Dolly the sheep has been cloned. A lot of other animals have been cloned. Cloning in itself doesn't really seem to be that tricky. So if humans put their minds to it, I don't think cloning humans would be particularly hard, harder than any specific animal. Whether or not you're going to end up with that sort of uniformity, if your aim was to do a clone army, then you would want to properly control, first of all, the wombs. So you would want to make sure that, you know, if you're not using artificial wombs, which I'm actually assuming they're doing in Star Wars.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Well, Padme, she gives like Luke and Leia's mother, she does give like physical birth, doesn't she?
Yeah. But that one, of course, was different. The what was it? Genosis was the planet where they did all the cloning, and it was in kind of the artificial wombs, and they were just churning them out like crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Because then you could, you know, have a really controlled environment there. So I guess yes.
And yeah, but then remember, even in the movie though, remember how Jango Fett wants his
unaltered clone.
Yes.
Now, what he meant by that was the clones during their development were given certain extra chemicals after they were born to suppress, obviously, certain things and emphasize certain others. But he wanted an unaltered clone to actually have as his son. So I guess, like, humans, when they're born, it's one thing if you can guarantee a physiological, identical situation, but you can't guarantee that psychological identical thing, whereas one of them might have a propensity to be a cook, not a sniper. So you have to kind of suppress any of those creative urges, get rid of stuff like any type of ADD, which stops them concentrating on certain things, and try and artificially guide them all towards this same path. But I guess in theory, unless you could do something very specific to the brain, that you wouldn't be guaranteed very thorough results.
Exactly. So I think what happens is that even if you have the same genetics, the same sort of chemical environment in the womb, and then the same sort of, you know, environment growing up, you're still going to have a situation where there are some variety, just because of, basically because of coincidence. Like there's still a lot of coincidences going in and out on in our body. And then, of course, in the Clone Wars, and the clones created also have these sort of unhuman qualities, because you're not going to end up with that kind of easily controlled, you're going to end up with humans, and humans are not easily controlled. We're kind of learning, or that's really obvious. So you're not going to take away humanity just by making a lot of copies of the same same person, you know, as same as what you mentioned with this, the son of his. That seems to be the really tricky part. And you know, if you can figure out a way to take away personality, then there's no really need to start out with clones anyway. Then you could just start out with people who have the physiological traits that you're looking for.
Yeah, makes sense. Kind of, backing a little bit away from humans. I mean, for years, let's use horses, for instance. So there's still, to this day, people that put horses out to stud, that have won horse races, and they're trying to say, hey, you know, let's get this horse paired up with another mare so we can make the next great racehorse. I mean, we've been kind of doing this for centuries, essentially, as a society, but then we figured out that doesn't always work. You know, just because you mate a pair of horses that both have these great lineages from horse racing doesn't make the next great horse race or horse that can win horse races, right? So this is the stair step beyond that. It's like, hey, we tried the analog way, and now this is more the digital way.
But I think also, and I know there's some discussion of doing, I think there's actually been cloned race horses born. And I know there are some looking into some, you know, for cattle as well, but it's especially sort of race horses and race camels. At least there's a lot of research going in into cloning those. And I think even in those cases, there's been some mixed results, I think, because you're always going to have individual variants that aren't controllable, basically, and that are basically due to coincidence and just, you know, whatever, you know, luck or how to phrase it.
Right.
Yeah, I did have another question, but on behalf, tell us about race camels.
Yes, that's exactly. I do not know what a race camel is, but I have got to know what a race camel is.
But camel races is a really big sport.
I have never heard of camel racing.
Must be out in West Texas, because they don't do it here.
Do you seriously not want to go on YouTube right now and watch a camel race?
Hopefully, they're ridden by midgets.
And
that would be fantastic.
No, they're ridden. A lot of them are ridden by robots.
Oh, even better.
Yes.
Robot.
So
midgets.
They used to be.
Yeah, you know, no, tell us about camel racing. That will really mess with the search algorithms right now.
Toril never thought when she woke up this morning that she'd be talking about
camel racing.
Robot camel racing, yeah.
I have to say, I'm not an expert, but yeah, camel racing, fairly big sports, lots of money involved in betting. It used to be, same as with jockeys and horses, that you want really small riders. Doesn't weigh as much. It and is. So I know to some extent humans have been replaced by robots as camel riders.
Wait, stop. I thought she was kidding about the robot jockeys. You're serious?
I can't say how common it is. I can't say that, you know, all camels are ridden by robot jockeys, but yes, it exists.
Do you just not want to sell everything you have and go buy robot camel jockeys and just invest everything in it and just do that for a living? Mm-hmm. Like, talk about learning something new every day. This is fantastic. Robot camel jockeys. God,
you see, the worrying thing from this podcast is that the rest of the world already thinks the United States is pretty sheltered. And within the United States, there's a lot of states who think Texas is sheltered. We're just kind of running with that.
Yes.
Yeah, we are the catalyst to that general opinion.
I am fascinated by this.
I'm sure you're going to have listeners who know, you know, a lot more about camel racing than I know. I think I basically sort of transferred all of my knowledge of this subject to you now. But I really hope you take it up in the future. I would love to hear an episode about camel racing.
It'll get a mention, believe me. Now, we did mention earlier
Dubai Camel Racing Club. Mm. The heritage sport of the United Arab Emirates. Mm. Look at that. Oh, this is amazing. You probably lost me. Now I'm just going to want to read about camel racing. This is fabulous.
Right. When we talked about a two-tiered evolution system, if certain nations decide not to take part in bioengineering, and, you know, the Eastern world does, particularly China, isn't it going to lead to eventually some type of environmental catastrophe? Because if we start producing humans who are living to like 130, 140 years old, and people just aren't dying off, and diseases almost completely eliminated, or new variants are projected against already, are we not pushing towards that overpopulation where we're going to end up destroying the planet with our own intelligence rather than the kind of direction they think it's going to be destroyed right at the moment? We're going to kind of kill it with kindness in a way.
Yeah, I see where you're going. This is an area where I'm actually fairly optimistic. So maybe not about the way China uses this kind of technology. Did you find the robots?
I just showed him. There is a picture of robots riding camels in Dubai. This is amazing.
It is, isn't it?
Toril, do you want to place any bets as to what we're going to be watching on YouTube the moment we all stop talking?
Oh my gosh.
Come on, we'll look at videos on YouTube afterwards, I promise you. We'll spend a good 20 minutes
watching the videos. Okay. So you're telling me to get rid of my ADD and focus back on the podcast and not that fantastic picture of the three robots riding camels on a horse track.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
It is.
It is, isn't it? Okay, so to get back to your question, I think, so looking at what is happening in the world now, we are seeing that as societies are getting richer, and especially as women in societies are getting more autonomy over their own body and getting autonomy over their own economy, it's very clear that birth rates are falling. So about half of the world's population now lives in countries where the birth rate is lower than what is called replacement level, which basically means that each woman has less than two children. And this is a fairly consistent trend that doesn't really seem to be that affected by things like societal norms or religion or political agendas. It's really very clear. And in some areas, it's falling so low that it's a real problem. Japan, South Korea are examples of that, and also Spain and Italy. And But this trend is so consistent that I can't see it not continuing. So I think that if we're in a situation where most of us starts living till we're about 130, we're probably going to have children either later or fewer. I mean, one of the things that's, there's still not much research in delaying menopause, so you're still going to have a situation where you need to have those children quite early in life, but probably a lot fewer of them. So when it comes to overpopulation, I'm not that worried. I'm worried about a few other ways to use these technologies, but not about that. And this might be a bit naive. I know this is a bit of a naive belief that I have, but I hope that when people are in a situation where they're actually going to be themselves alive in 100 years, they might take a bit more responsibility for things like climate change or environmental problems, because it's not going to be the problems of their children or their grandchildren. It's actually going to be their problems.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be your problem if you can't live in this spot in 50 years, as opposed to now when it's, you know, it's, I'm not going to say that people are evil, but it's very easy to not care about problems that will happen after you're dead. It really is.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the cost to this is pretty prohibitive at the moment. And if it could be done to scale, then possibly outside of somebody like China creating a clone army, it probably wouldn't be done to scale, because outside of trying to get yourself an instant like slave workforce, doing it on scale, there's not really any type of moral reason perhaps to do that. But if we get to that point where we have the technology to be able to do it en masse and cheaply, at that point, isn't it just better to eradicate these issues with a merging of like humans and machine, go the transhumanism route, than actually look into constantly using biology that maybe we can correct some of these things with technology? So, you know, a computer inside us controls certain ways our body reacts, rather than trusting our biological process, which sometimes might cause us to, you know, have autoimmune things where our own immune system, whereas, you know, a computer inside us can say to the immune system, hey, calm down, stop attacking your own body, etc. Do you see that as an inevitable in the future, that there's going to be more and more of a merging of humans and machines?
I think so. And I think, I mean, we are already merging ourselves with machines and technology to a large extent. I'm, you know, tapping my glasses again as an example of that. You know, this is technology. It might have been around for 1,000 years almost by now. Yeah, almost 1,000 years. About 800, I think. But this, you know, is this technology? If I break my hip and get a titanium replacement hip, that is technology. And, you know, there are very, very few people today that can quote the Iliad or the Odyssey, as a lot of people actually could in the Mediterranean era, in ancient Greek, for example. And we can't do it anymore because there's no need to. Like, there's no need for us because we have placed that part of our memory and of our brains in books, and now we place it in computers. So we already do this sort of constant merging between ourselves and technology, and that's, of course, going to be a lot more, I'm not going to say invasive, but, you know, it's going to be more tactile and more sort of even more into our bodies. But, you know, I don't remember the birthdays of most of my friends because I know I have technology that will remind me of it. That is a way of becoming a transhuman, if you will, even if we don't really think about it like that. Even if you haven't, if you have most women use technology to control if they will give birth or not, like if they will get pregnant or not. That is a huge transhuman step. That is massive.
Right.
And I think this will, you know, continue, of course.
I think kind of along the lines of memorizing phone numbers. I used to memorize everybody's phone number. I never carried around a piece of paper with anybody's phone number. I just memorized them. And I probably only have about 5 or 6 phone numbers left of current people that I talk to, because people change phone numbers and this, that, and the other. I can still remember all the phone numbers from way back in the day. But if I think about calling him or texting him or whatever, I just put his name in the phone. I don't think about the phone number because I've taken that part out and then said, okay, you know, phone, you take care of this for me because I'm going to use my brain for something else, which kind of leads me into the next part about what old Elon Musk is doing with, you know, the Neuralink. So now we've gotten rid of that part of our brain that remembers our friends' birthdays or remembers phone numbers. And now we've used this external device. Now we're going to skip ahead to that external device actually messing with our mind. Tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of looking into that and what you see the future of that is.
I think the type of technology that Neuralink is looking into and a few other companies, I think that's going to be really helpful in very specific cases. So it's kind of technology is already really useful if you have if you can't move your arms or legs, if you're paralyzed or something like that. This technology is really, really useful. And it's also really now developing interesting sort of feedback technology from prostheses so that you can sort of feel heat or pressure or cold with your technological limbs. Other than that, I think Neuralink and similar technologies are interesting, but I think that they undervalue the amount of learning and adapting we do with our brain. So I actually did a radio show on this subject, and I talked to a few researchers that work with both robotics and humans. And they talked a lot about, you know, if you do this kind of implant, it's going to take as long to learn using it as it took you to learn talking when you were a child or to walk or something like that. Like we tend to think that it's going to be like the Matrix, like you press a button and you're like, I know Kung Fu. Or, you know, I know how to fly this helicopter. And that is, there's no, you know, biology doesn't really work that way. Biology is amazing, mainly because it is adaptive. Mainly because, you know, our brains will have the ability to adapt to these new tools. But it will be an adaption. And an adaption means a training period and time. And actually going into learning these things, which means that I think that will be extremely useful, but only if there are very specific needs that are being met. So there's been some discussion about things or people that need to have extremely fast reaction times. So fighter pilots, for example, has been one group where that kind of direct, where he doesn't have to go through the muscles, basically he can go from brain to no action, and also some discussion about perhaps surgeries or surgeons and things where you can spend a few years learning that tactile sense of the tools directly into your brain rather than going through your fingers. But I think we're going to have to assume that there's going to be sort of year-long learning phases with these interfaces to our brains, even if we get them to work.
Yeah. Now, to what extent can bioengineering affect the neurological process? Because if you're going to have humans live to 125 or 150, and we're still at a situation where diseases like Alzheimer's are still on the rise, and say somebody gets Alzheimer's at age 75 or 80, they then live the next 50 years with Alzheimer's, which, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, if I get Alzheimer's, then, you know, pull the plug on me or shoot me or smother me with a pillow or whatever favorite method they might have. But I mean, surely we're going to have to be able to keep up on all parts of the body. Otherwise, we're just like an empty shell walking around, you know, like a soulless body. You know, bioengineering get to the point where we can actually start affecting brain diseases as well as we can the rest of the body?
I think so, yes. I think what happens in our bodies as we age, and that includes things like Alzheimer's and also sort of more generalized dementia and things like that, is that from an evolutionary standpoint, our bodies are a constant trade-off. We spend some energy repairing ourselves, making sure there aren't too much mutations, killing off cancer cells and things like that. But our body traits that have like a trade-off where that energy is on one side, and on the other side is making sure we produce as many babies as we can. So from an evolutionary standpoint, what happens to you after you're no longer fertile doesn't really matter. You know, it's humans, it's a bit special. We're a bit special because we live on a few decades after we've lost our fertility, mainly because it seems like grandparents are extremely important to children or have been in human history. But the thing is that from an evolutionary standpoint, you know, it doesn't care what happens to your body as you age, because the children you are going to produce have already been produced. So you're kind of just waste, looking at it harshly. But those repairing systems that the body used earlier in life are still available. So I think a lot of the genetic technology when it comes to sort of just general health and general life extension is going to focus on keeping those systems active and sort of cheating evolution in that sense, and sort of keep our body spending time and energy on keeping us healthy, even when it doesn't really make any evolutionary sense. And those systems are already there, they're already in place. And I think it's going to be fairly likely that we are able to start using them, at least to have a healthy lifespan up to about 115 for a lot of us.
Okay, now I just wanted to talk real quick about the COVID-19 vaccines. Are they an example of using biohacking to tailor make targeted medicines towards the human body? And do you think there's a danger in using a one-size-fits-all method, because the receptor of that targeted treatment is very different? And obviously, there's always going to be side effects in drugs. Somebody's always going to react to something. You know, I can eat 16 pounds of peanuts and be fine. Somebody else might sniff a Snickers wrapper, which was left a week ago, and drop down dead. But, you know, could you explain, because over here we get a very political view of science when people talk about it, and it would be nice to hear somebody from a different country kind of explain how the COVID vaccines work.
Yeah, so I think the COVID vaccines, basically all of them, are really interesting examples of how quickly this technology can be put to use when there's focus of it. So there was only, I think it was less than a month between the fact that the virus was actually properly identified and the fact that its genome was online, published, open access, anyone could use it to start working on treatments and vaccines. So there are two types of vaccines out there. There are the standard antibody vaccines, and then they are the new version of vaccines, which are mRNA vaccines, which are the COVID vaccines are like the first large scale use of that kind of vaccines. Both of them, in a simplified way, they both work in the same way. They give our immune system a template. It's basically like sending in like a gun with loose shots in it. That's a bad analogy, but you know, something that
does it have anything to do with camels and robots riding the camels? Because I would love for you to like analogize this together.
Yes. Tie this in your second or third language.
Yes.
Yes. So basically, it would be like sending in a stuffed camel with, you know, a small handful of wires tied to its back. Like you send in something that isn't dangerous in itself, like that will not make you sick in itself, but it is recognizable to your immune system. So your immune system, when your immune system first encounters anything, it will react to it in varying degrees, and it will sort of save up that information. Now, the amount of time it saves it varies for different kind of diseases. Some of them you can get a vaccination during your first years, and then you will actually be protected from that disease for the rest of your life. Other things will only be sort of stored for shorter amounts of time. And you also have a situation where viruses sort of change. But what you do, and you send in this stuffed camel with a handful of wires on it, and your immune system goes, this looks really dangerous. We have to make sure that we, you know, put this in the library, that we can fight this. And it seems, you know, we got it now, so we will build up an army of anti-camel cells so that we can attack them. Yeah, and we can attack the actual camels when they come along.
Makes sense.
Because they think this stuffed camel is a proper camel. They can't tell the difference.
Right. And so then, our immune system, though, basically prioritizes what is more dangerous than other things is kind of what you're alluding to, right? Am I following you right?
And also, if it already knows that something is around, it will be able to build up a defense. So then when you get like a proper camel with a robot on it, when you actually get infected with the COVID virus, you're already going to have a prepared immune system that can quickly attack the virus cells so that they can't sort of sneak around and infect you for long enough for you to actually get sick and start spreading it to other people. So it's kind of like a, you know, you send in something that gives them, you know what it is? It's like, do a Star Wars analogy. It's like actually giving the maps of the Death Star to the,
all right,
to R2-D2 the revolution, so that, you know, they can recognize the Death Star when they see it and already have a plan of attack.
Right, they know where they can attack it and take care of it the easiest way.
Exactly. So it's kind of like that. It's like giving a blueprint of the Death Star, getting that into the right hands.
I'm struggling here because I love the Star Wars reference, but I think I like the camel reference better. I'm so infatuated with camel racing right now. I know it's just wearing you out. It is wearing you out that I'm that fascinated with it. But, man, I want to watch camel racing now.
Now, I did mention earlier about biohacking. Now, if somebody makes the decision that, you know, it's really good for humans going forward, if we alter this particular gene or sequence of genes in every single individual, because it will lead to their descendants not having these type of diseases, or, you know, will stop neurotypical diseases taking hold or whatever. But what happens if somebody makes a mistake and we suddenly pass on to all future generations something which is cataclysmic and we couldn't see it coming, because at that point, when we went through all the simulation, the technology we had couldn't actually come up with an in-depth enough, you know, I guess, list of what potentially could happen down the line. So how do we avoid that doomsday scenario in trying to do good? We accidentally destroy the species.
So that is actually one of the main reasons why most researchers are against using gene editing in embryos, is the fact that you cannot foresee the consequences 2, 3, 4 generations down the line. And I mentioned the He Zhangku, the Chinese researcher who already did this. From the scarce data that he actually showed on that conference, it was clear that the mutation that he produced wasn't exactly what he was going for. So to some extent, this already happened, that he produced a completely new mutation where we don't really know if it's going to have the same effect of protecting these girls from HIV, or if it's going to have a detrimental effect, or if it's going to have no effect at all. Most mutations actually don't lead to any consequences whatsoever. And then you're going to have the added problem of, you know, will this have an effect later in life? Will this have an effect in generation 3? Will this have an effect if combined with another gene editing that has happened in another line? So, you know, 5 generations down the line, when these two people meet and have children, you're going to have unforeseen effects, because from this line you have one editing and from this line you have another, and suddenly, you know, the most sad and likely results would not be the end of humanity, but two people who wouldn't be able to have biological children, for example, or would have horrible diseases or miscarriages or something like that. And that those kind of snowball consequences are likely and very hard to control for.
Does that kind of go into like interbreeding and, you know, whether you talk about humans or you talk about like people that breed dogs and, you know, you can't, you know, breed the same litter from, you know, a female dog that presents this litter and they are great puppies. And obviously you can't breed those two puppies together from the same litter because all of a sudden now you're going to get those mutations or genetic defects or whatever. Are you kind of talking along those same lines with that?
You might have similar effects, but you're not going to get that kind of inbreeding effects from just specific singular mutations, because the inbreeding effects usually comes from the fact that large swaths of the gene material is identical. And then so in most areas it's good to have quite a lot of variation. It's good for us to have different variants of genes from our fathers and our mothers. But there are some diseases where if you have the same copies, then you end up with a disease. But if you only carry one of these copies of the gene, then you're fine. And those kind of sort of large swaths effect, you're not going to get with this technology. But we might end up with situations where if rather than curing diseases, we do things that are more status connected. So if we end up with a lot of mutations for muscle growth, for example, for specific eye colors, for specific hair colors, then you might end up with these problems as well, that a lot of people carry similar mutations that are probably not perfect to combine with each other.
Yeah. Now, I haven't mentioned your book too much today because I don't want to ruin it for potential readers, but I did have a question about it. One of your chapters is called Build Your Own Baby. Now, if I was going to pick up a book on bioengineering, I would expect that chapter to be in there. But you have a chapter called Storm in a Bowl of Yogurt. Could you explain, without giving too much away about your book, what that's about?
So Storm in a Bowl of Yogurt, it is actually how the latest big version of genetic editing was discovered. So a lot of people have heard about CRISPR gene editing. It's the latest tool, and it's really, really useful. It makes gene editing, whether it's in humans or in yeast or in animals or in plants or whatever, it makes it easy and cheap and affordable and very effective. And it was actually discovered in yogurt. Because it turns out if you make a lot of yogurt, then you have milk and you have bacteria, and you want the bacteria to live in the yogurt. That's how you make yogurt. We are very aware of viruses attacking humans right now after the COVID years. But it turns out that most viruses are not attacking even animals. Most viruses are attacking bacteria. There's huge swaths of viruses who only attack bacteria. So if you're a yogurt maker, you're going to have a problem. Because if you get viruses that attack your bacteria, you're not going to get good yogurt. So yogurt makers actually do, specifically Danish yogurt makers, did some research into bacterial strains that were more resistant to virus attacks. And it turned out that they had a more robust immune system, and that immune system was based on them having targeted genetic scissors that could basically cut up virus DNA when it entered the bacteria. So the bacteria could protect themselves with these genetic scissors that could recognize viral DNA when it entered them and then cut it up before it caused any damage. And it turned out that these genetic scissors could be reprogrammed. So that is basically what CRISPR is. It's a very short explanation. I understand if it sort of leads to more questions than it answers, but it is a way for us to sort of hacking and reuse bacterial immune system for our own purposes. And it gives humans the ability to sort of cut genetic material in whatever way we use. Kind of going from a 16th century big bronze cannon to a sniper gun in sort of pinpoint accuracy.
No, that makes sense. So, fantastic information, a lot to digest here. And of course, we've just kind of scraped the surface of this. So can you let everybody know, a little bit more about your book, where they can find your book, where they can reach out to you and, maybe ask you some questions, how to find you on social media, things like that?
Yeah, sure. So the book called The Unnatural Selection of Our Species should be available basically everywhere that you can buy a book right now. That includes also probably you could get it ordered to your local library as well. And, please support your local bookseller. I think that's really important, especially as an author. I also, when it comes to the sort of Order a Baby, I did a homepage called Order a Baby, where you can sort of play around with this technology. It's sort of based on a future company where you can order your baby from. So it's fake, but it gives you a good idea of what might be possible. So I'll give you the link and you can put that up as well. Other than that, I'm on Twitter. You can find me by searching for my name, and you will probably find that in the links as well, rather than me giving it to you now. I also have a Facebook page, and you can find me on my web page, which I'll give you a link to instead of just giving the letters right now.
Gotcha. No, that's fantastic. So we don't normally do this, but I'm going to put you on the spot here. So I want you to do that exact same thing that you just did and explain everything, but I want you to do it in Swedish.
In Swedish. So explaining where
Did. Yeah. Now we got to hear your native language. So okay. We're going to sit here and we're not going to have a clue what you're saying. You could be giving some, ideas of who to bet on the camel races for or whatever, sure. But we just want to hear some Swedish before we sign off.
Of course. Så min bok på svenska heter Människan och provröret. Den finns både som pocket och som vanlig bok. Och den finns oavsett var ni vill köpa böcker eller beställa till bibliotek. Jag finns på Twitter, jag finns på Facebook och jag finns lite grann ibland på Instagram. Jag har också gjort en hemsida där man kan testa hur det kommer vara i framtiden att beställa sin egen bebis. Så jag blir jätteglad om ni kollar på länkarna som jag har visat.
That did sound a lot like the chef from The Muppets, though, didn't it?
Yeah, but I did hear Facebook and Instagram in there. I mean, that is one of my favorite things about hearing somebody speak a foreign language, right?
And then
when you have those words and it's like Facebook, and it's like, oh, I got that one. I got that one. Well, hey, Toril, thanks so much for joining us today. We certainly learned a lot. We appreciate it. I am going to now spend the rest of the day looking up camel racing. So, thank you for that. And that will do it for this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. And we will catch you on the next.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.